Fine, you were starting to bore me anyway. Shots, fired in rapid succession, echoed like cannons in the small room, followed by the sharp din of shattering glass. Shards of broken window hit the floor around her. After a few seconds of utter silence, she peeked around the edge of a partition. Claudio was slumped on the floor, blood pooling around his unmoving form. Shit. He seemed like a genuinely nice guy. Raoul crouched behind a workstation two down from Kate. He produced what looked like a slender silver flashlight from his pocket. He pointed one end at Coulson. A ray of purple light flashed from it. The ray missed Coulson, but only because he leaped like a man-sized insect from one side of the room to the other. Upon landing as easily as a ballet dancer, he spun and fired his gun yet again. This time, one of his shots grazed Raoul, who fell back with a yelp. Fuck, they'd all be dead in less than 20 seconds at this rate. She had to do something. But what? No gun? That had been established, but she had the ring that Jason had sent her across with his first failed clone. The same ring he'd used to get inside Raoul's head. Maybe if she flashed it, she could trigger some kind of hesitation on Coulson's part. He was a clone of Jason, after all. Then she'd try to tackle the bastard. She pulled the ring from her pocket and slipped it on. It was oddly cool to the touch. Unexpectedly, the contact calmed her. Somehow she knew it was all going to be all right. She just had to concentrate on what she wanted. So what did she desire? She wanted Coulson gone, that's what. So she focused on the man. It suddenly struck her just how out of place he was. He shouldn't be here. He just stepped through a portal from some other world, a world that wasn't even actually real. It wasn't right. The hairs on her arm rose like they sometimes did when she watched electrical storms. Before her better sense could convince her she was committing suicide, she rose, pointing at Coulson with the hand wearing the ring, and said, "You're not welcome here." A confluence of fundamental forces, she wasn't sure what else to call them, jolted him from all directions, curling out of dimensions normally too small to be seen. Coulson went rigid, as if held in place by a massive electric current running through him. His wrongness, she knew, his presence on Earth when he was native to Ardeen, added to the effectiveness of what she'd done, whatever that was. The weird bubble of calmness she had been acting in popped. What the fucking hell? She glanced at Raoul. Raoul said to her, "See? I told you. You didn't need a gun, Michula. You're quickened."
"I didn't do that."
"Well, I didn't do it," said Raoul, his tone reasonable. Kate looked back at Coulson. He was still rigid and vibrating, but she sensed that whatever effect she'd triggered, it wouldn't last long. They had a minute at most, or maybe far less.
"What should we do?"
"What we came to do." Raoul produced another device from his pocket. "A miniature grenade?"
"These should do the trick."
Raoul pressed a contact on the side. He tossed it overhand through the broken window at the machine that still vibrated there. An iridescent green explosion of light consumed the grenade, the computer, and half the side room. The roar of the explosion was loud, but not as loud as Kate would have expected. It was over before Kate even thought to move back. The computer was simply gone, as was the floor in a roughly circular area around where it had been. That's when Kate realized that she hadn't been flung back by a grenade blast, a blast that had essentially happened only about 15 feet in front of her. Grenades normally killed within 15 feet, and sometimes a lot farther.
"Cipher," said Raoul,
as if that explained things. It didn't. Then he walked up to the blur hanging in the air. It was noticeably smaller than before.
"Come on, Michula. We must go through and destroy the sister facility. Before this translation gate collapses, it could take us months to find where we need to go, if we don't go through now.
Her head was spinning, but she knew exactly what Raoul was proposing, so she didn't ask him if he was insane, pretend she didn't understand his intent, or otherwise try to fend off the inevitable, because she suspected he was right. But if she thought too much about it, she still might not agree. But first, she picked up Coulson's gun and aimed it directly at Coulson, who still wasn't moving. Her finger touched the trigger, then fell away. What had she done to him when she pointed at him? Now that she had a gun, part of her wanted to shoot Coulson, not so much because he probably deserved, but because she wanted to negate what had just happened, what she'd just done. She wanted the crazy to go away. Raoul looked at her.
I don't blame you for not shooting a defenseless man, nor will I think any worse of you if you do.
But decide!
Fuck it, she whispered. Kate lowered the gun and jumped with Raoul through the rapidly closing translation gate. Chapter 23 Expedition Jason Cole. The last hints of Ardeen's atmosphere whispered away. Jason plunged into a sea of spiraling fractal patterns, iterating upon themselves like snakes, forever eating their own tails. A shock of bluish-purple color dazed him. Flashes of gold, orange, and blood-red light seared his retinas. He blinked repeatedly. Twists and turns of the shapes shimmering all around him seemed chaotic. But when he followed any single edge, his mind picked out maddeningly complex patterns that threatened a headache like nothing he'd previously experienced. If Jason hadn't been mounted on the Dalama, he would have foundered. Merid had sent the Ring of Silence into the Strange to keep it out of his hands before she and he reached Detente. He didn't fully trust her, so he'd suggested they retrieve the ring together, despite the fact that Jason had never previously dared to enter the Strange. If the Kray found him in their domain, without the rules of Ardeen to enforce their mutual agreements, they'd consume him in an instant. Well, probably not instantly. He was war, after all, even out here. It was the Kray matriarch he feared. The longer he stayed out here, the more likely she'd come for him. But he needed the Ring of Silence. It was go after it or give up on a century of effort. Even so, he might not have risked the trip if Merid hadn't agreed to guide them safely. In return for the ring, he'd promised to reward her generously after he entered the Maker's Hall. The dragon had warned that his senses would be confused in the alien environment, so he'd been ready. He just hadn't realized that the Strange was going to be like this. The visual phenomena were gut-churning. But it was the unexpected odor that left him gasping. Jason smelled a dusty, slightly mildewed basement bedroom. The odor triggered his childhood memories with the vividness of a bullet through a window. He was back in his bed in his parents' drafty house, hearing the sounds of the ghost that had tormented him. Remembering which were real memories wasn't easy for Jason anymore. He suffered from recollection overload. In addition to his actual childhood experiences, all those imposed by the incarnation of war's fake history also flooded his head, not to mention all memories he'd earned the old-fashioned way in the last 200-odd years he'd been marooned in Ardeen. The rare times Jason tried remembering being a kid in Kansas, the memories cross-circuited. Instead of green grass and trees, he saw one of 100 apocalyptic battles between dragons, Keflum, humans, Dlama, demons, and incarnations that had happened during the Age of Myth. Sometimes he remembered plunging a burning blade in the Maker's back. Or he'd recall some other detail of his existence as an incarnation that had nothing to do with the ranch-style house where he actually grew up. When it came to his mother, Nancy Cole, or his father, Avery Cole, Jason came up almost completely blank. He could barely remember their names, let alone their faces. How they treated him, or any formative childhood lessons they provided. All except for the ghost thing, of course. Avery, whatever his other strengths or weaknesses might have been as a parent, also apparently thought that instilling a healthy fear of the dark was important for his child. To that end, he occasionally snuck downstairs and went into the room next to Jason's, where the washer and dryer, the furnace, and the extra freezer were located. Avery proceeded to make ghost noises from the other side of the wall. He groaned, growled, and sighed like a lost spirit. Avery did this after Jason had already gone to bed, of course, not long after Jason made the perilous run from the light switch back to the protective blankets of his bed. He'd known the noises were coming from his father, not a ghost. He wasn't stupid. But the ghostly groans had terrified him anyway. He'd been a kid. Normally, such old memories, when he could pull them up at all, were faded like paper left in the sun. Colorless and drab, they lacked sting. But not this time. This time, the memory of being afraid in his bed brain-slammed Jason. The sound of his father pretending to be the ghost was all he could hear. The darkness under the blankets and their particular odor was all he could see and smell. The sounds terrified him, pulling an answering cry of negation from him in a hoarse whisper. "War?" came Merid's voice, dragging Jason back to the moment. He was still astride his Dlama, its wings spread wide, using them to surf the dark energy boil. Next to the Dlama flew Merid, transformed into her real shape, a massive dragon, with brilliant feathered wings more than twice as far from tip to tip as the Dlama's. Jason was in the strange. After what Carter had described on his first exposure, an endless, shuddering expanse deeper than any real sky, an infinite, wheeling eternity where hunger stirred. Jason decided to never chance it himself. Yet here he was, smelling that same smell as the basement beneath his bed, remembering those same traumas he'd dismissed and forgotten as silly childhood fears. "Are you leaving me already? What kind of failed incarnation are you?" Merid said, drawing him back from his recollections a second time. "Whatever you're seeing or feeling, it's not real. It's an effect of this realm on the mind. I told you to be ready." Jason concentrated on gathering his strength. The warmth of embarrassment flushed his face. It was a feeling he hadn't endured in years. "I'm fine." He focused his eyes just ahead and above the Dlama's head, where a void between two larger fractals created a zone free of mind-bending patterns. The Dlama seemed unfazed by what lay all around them, as did Merid. "You're making sounds like a child. At least, I think it was a child," said Merid. Her draconic visage swiveled on her long neck to regard him quizzically. "Maybe. But the fit has passed," he said. "How is it that you and the Dlama aren't affected? This place seems designed to tear minds asunder." The dragon's scaled lips drew back into something probably meant to be a smile. "For my part, I'm still surprised one of those would agree to bear you, of all people." Merid's closer wing dipped, indicating the Dlama. Was she avoiding his question? Maybe she was trying to direct his thoughts away from the precipice. So he decided to go with it. "What, you think all Dlamas are champions of the weak and downtrodden in Ardeen?" The Dlama, bearing Jason, flew on without giving the least indication that it understood their conversation, though of course it could. Dlamas originally were the steeds of the Kephlum, who fought against the human dragon riders serving Lotan during the Age of Myth. At least according to the prehistory of the fake recursion Jason called home. Even the ones who no longer uphold the seven rules, the twisted ones, seem unlikely to serve a master however powerful, pressed Merid. So long as I allow it to hunt one of my homunculi every month or so, it agrees to bear me. Interesting, Merid said. And now I understand. Did you know, usually when I meet a Dlama, it's a fight? The dragon turned its gaze on the Dlama as they winged through the void, as if challenging it. It ignored her completely. Jason stilled his instinct to pat the Dlama on the neck, which he knew from personal experience could cause it to buck him off. Here in the Strange, would that be lethal? Maybe you can fight later, Jason said. For the 100th time, Jason mentally checked his connection to his ring, and through it, the directional fix he had on the Ring of Silence. It still lay ahead. If Merid was leading him into a trap, at least it was baited with what he needed. How far? Jason asked. Merid shrugged, which was a sort of full-body movement for her. She said, it's not so much distance as time. Locations are relative out here. Everything is constantly changing. Finding a way between them requires that you mentally memorize beacons and signposts and concentrate on reaching them. Jason craned his head around and looked behind him. He'd expected to see Ardeen growing smaller in the distance. Instead, he saw only more of the Strange, stretching away to infinity behind them. As he considered whether or not to comment on the feeling of being utterly lost, he spied a hazy, translucent bubble in the far distance. Ardeen was hundreds of miles across, but the sphere was hardly a fraction of that, and growing smaller every minute as the Dlama and dragon flew on. He focused his gaze upon the sphere, committing it to memory. Merid's head twisted round, and her lips drew back into another smile, though he was beginning to have his doubts about the expression. That sphere, Jason said, it's Ardeen's beacon, yeah? It'll serve that purpose, she said, and her smile fled. It reappeared on Jason's face, his first one in the Strange. At least that was one thing she couldn't hold over him. Not to be pedantic, then, but how long until we reach this hidden enclave of yours? It's variable. Several more hours, at least. Perhaps we can pass the time by you telling me more of this Earth. I've heard you speak of it, and what's kept you so busy at your foundries. Jason rubbed his chin. I don't recall telling you anything about Earth. Yet I seem to know about it. Maybe I learned about it from my spies, she laughed. Jason seriously doubted Merid had anyone on the inside of his operation. Everyone was him, for fuck's sake. He wouldn't betray himself. Then again, he was kind of a dick. And sometimes, the clones created using the body vats were unreliable. He looked forward to the day all his power returned, and he could scrap those homunculi completely. His lieutenants, in particular, had it coming. Well, you got me there, Jason said, so fair's fair. Explain what else you've learned about this insane place we're flying through. If you got a lair out here, you must have been out here before. Most critters of Ardeen remain stuck in the narrative of the Land of the Curse. Stuck in the narrative. Fascinating way of putting it. I'll have to remember that. But I woke up. Maybe partly because of your own actions, upsetting everything when you slew the Maker. I discovered the land I lived in was only one of many limited worlds, all adrift in the Strange. Something about the dragon's explanation bothered Jason. He was certain she was leaving something out. But he nodded along. She continued. One world isn't so limited, is it? The world you come from
Earth.
Just how did you learn about that? You're not the first version of yourself who I've had the pleasure of speaking with. You've cast so many of yourselves away over the years. Luckily for me, most versions of you are fairly compliant. When enough pain is applied. Jason reined the llama to a stop so that they hung drifting in the void. Merid flew past, then dipped one wing to curve her flight so that she entered a wide orbit around them. "What's wrong?" she called. That damn smile was back on her muzzle. "How many of my homunculi have you interrogated?" he asked with a sinking feeling. It was a stalling tactic. She probably knew his entire plan, and she'd lured him out here for a reason, probably not the one he thought. "I've lost count. The odd thing is that despite all of them being copies of you, they were all a little different. They all died differently, some defiantly, some pleading, others in stoic silence. Isn't that fascinating?" "Yeah." Jason craned his head back along their route, looking for the sphere he'd earlier spied. It was gone, too far behind him. But he'd marked it as a beacon, as the dragon had described. He hoped that would be enough. Merid continued, "So I wonder how you will die now that your time has come." "You can't hope to beat me in a fight, Merid, for all your strength. I am war, and a measure of my incarnation has returned to me." To demonstrate, and to see if he could draw on the power of war while in this crazy realm, he threw off a handful of armored duplicates. None of them had mounts to support them, so they hung in the emptiness around him like paratroopers in free fall. He swallowed a sigh of relief. Their heads began swiveling in unison, tracking the dragon. Merid fluidly widened her orbit, then said, "You're confident because you don't fully understand what it is to be a dragon. On the other wing, a dragon does not like to leave things to chance when she doesn't have to. It's not how I gained my current position by being sloppy, and it's why I brought you out here, where I have friends who are especially interested in you. What is it you call them? The Cray?"
"You didn't." "Oh, I did. They promised to give me anything I wanted if they could have you. And look, here they come now." The dragon pointed with a claw.
A stain was growing in the void in the direction they had been traveling. He'd noticed earlier, but had assumed it was yet another oddity of the network best not studied too closely. He focused his senses. The stain leaped into clarity.
It was composed of thousands of swarming Cray, swirling in their direction through the void like a school of starving razorfish. And he didn't doubt that behind the vanguard, their matriarch followed. Somewhere, in all that alien flesh, he sensed the ring of silence. "You bitch," he said to Merid, not quite able to keep his voice even, but not from fear. It was rage. "She ruined everything."
Jason reined his llama around and whispered,
"To Ardeen, as if your life depended on it."
The llama tucked its wings, banked sharply enough that Jason nearly fell off, then surged back the way they'd come. Merid easily paced them, leaving the handful of homunculi he'd summoned behind. He mentally commanded that they blunt the Cray advance for all the good it would do.
"Fleeing won't save you," Merid said from his left. Her wing had no trouble sculling through the void of the strange as she paced his llama.
He knew it was probably pointless, but decided to try. He yelled,
"Why do you think the Cray want me? If they kill me out here, where none of the seven rules apply, they render the agreements I made with them null and void. Those agreements are complicated. If I'm killed out here, it'll probably breach Ardeen's 7 rules. Nothing will prevent the Kray from pouring into the land of the curse. They won't stop until they've consumed everything, including you.
As if I could trust anything you tell me, she replied. The title Betrayer did not come to you for nothing.
Then she breathed a sheet of fire, hot as the sun, at him. His glama veered. The fire only singed them. Still, the skin along his back beneath his armor blistered. The glama's wingtips smeared trails of smoke.
Orr's aura kindled like a bonfire from the pain of his blistering skin, overcoming and magnifying him like the director of a 1,000-piece symphony orchestra. Well, 200-piece. He had time to marvel as the exultation of the drums built. Then he was no longer Jason. He was the incarnation of war.
He jumped away from his saddle, aiming at the dragon. The Dlama kept winging onward, without so much as a look backwards.
War drew his staff. It burst into flame, at least as bright as Merid's breath. The dragon banked upward to avoid his leap. His trajectory carried him through the void, as if he had wings of his own. Merid wasn't fast enough to completely evade his surprise attack. She roared as his fiery weapon crashed down on one wing and went tumbling away as the momentum of his own attack carried him onward. War realized it wasn't the wings of either the Dlama or the dragon that allowed them to travel through the strange. After all, the approaching Kray Armada had none. It was will. And of that, War had plenty. More than any dragon, however ancient and powerful. Before there were dragons, he had strode Ardeen as the manifestation of battle. War's trajectory abruptly curved. He came around, exhilaration burning through him like a forge fire, then accelerated like a bolt from a ballista towards Merid. The dragon, one wing hurt, still managed to react almost instantly. She extended her head and loosed another stream of fire. War didn't flinch. He accreted dozens of lesser selves around him with a thought, creating a barrier of flesh, which immediately began burning away like ablative armor, individual components screaming in searing agony. War felt the unbearable pain of his duplicate selves dying, but he didn't let his dive towards Merid falter. On one level he didn't care. On the field of battle, soldiers died. But on another level it shocked him. For an instance, his sense of self as Jason sparked back into existence. Like fire taking light, Jason's mind bloomed back to full control. Jason wavered even as he brought his staff around, connecting with Merid's head, but not lethally as the blow would have otherwise been. He allowed himself to think, damn it all, and War's aura faded away into the background once more. With the power of the ring only partially renewed, he didn't know when he'd be able to call on it again. But Merid didn't know that. She backed off, wings suddenly frantic, head unsteady from his blow. Then she fled, without another word or thought of trying to distract him. The Kray's advance now blotted out a quarter of the emptiness, and the scent that had nearly undone him was replaced with a sort of termite reek. They were so close! If he lingered any longer, the advancing wave would envelop him. His Dlama, understanding the better part of valor, was already far ahead of Jason, following the fleeing dragon. Words whispered out of the void behind him, from the massed throats, if they had throats, of the Kray. Or maybe it was in his head. He heard, "War of Ardeen, all your promises are due. We call them in now, as is our right, as we agreed.
give yourselves up to us.
No, screamed Jason, terror pouring like ice water down his spine. That wasn't our agreement.
He'd never needed to be war so desperately as then. But the incarnation seemed farther away than ever.
Could Dread give you a heart attack? Our agreement was open to change, as you agreed when we gave you the last gift, the one you used to touch your home in the universe of the real.
Just give me more time. Let me return to Ardeen, finish what I've started.
Sweat beaded on his lip, trickled down his back within his suddenly too warm armor.
Why should we?
That was a good question. The universe of the real, you called it. If you let me go now, I will open the way for you.
Of course he wouldn't actually do that, not really, would he?
McCrae didn't answer. Their advance didn't stop, but it slowed, as if to give him time. Time to betray not only everyone in Ardeen, but everyone on Earth.
No, Jason frowned. The Kray were easily manipulated, as he'd just proven again. They wouldn't get Earth. His home planet didn't deserve to be destroyed by inhuman monsters. If anyone were going to take over the planet, it was going to be him.
At that thought, a flicker of War's mantle pulsed once, bequeathing a gift before falling nascent once more.
Jason recalled the secret of moving in the strange that War had divined, the will to make a change.
Jason shot away from the advancing Kray front. His fiery staff left a smear of sooty ash across the void.
Chapter 24 Exploration Carter Morrison. A massive crater pocked the glass desert. Shards of silvery glass, larger than houses, surrounded the cavity. They were still sharp. Siraja had explained that it had once been a blister that had shattered. The resulting hole was called the Singing Crater because of the strange music that emerged from the cavity. The pirates sometimes heard it from miles away at night, high and fluting.
"Who makes the music?" I asked her as Nightstar wove between strands of broken glass.
The ship was close to the crater's edge. We stood along the railing watching the shards slip past. The sun was already well up, but a low cover of clouds kept things tolerably cool. Even though we were near our destination, I couldn't hear any harmonies.
"No one knows."
"Maybe we'll find the performer," she said, without much conviction.
"No one's gone to check before now? I find that hard to believe."
"Many have tried," she said.
"What became of them?"
"Let me guess, they never returned?"
She smiled.
"Not always.
Sometimes only parts returned. One of the princes in Mandariel sent a party of explorers into the crater 5 years ago. A few days after they were sent, the explorers' right hands were found piled in a heap on the floor of the prince's bedroom."
"That can't possibly be true. It's just a pirate's tale, right?"
She shrugged. She did that a lot. But I didn't take it as a slight. It was a kind of casual gesture normally shared only between friends. Early on, she may have regretted stepping in to help me. But since then, I like to believe we'd become friends, or at least friendly acquaintances.
"Regardless," I continued my thought, "if so many people are willing to risk their lives and dismemberment to find the sound's source, the music must be exquisite."
"It's mysterious, certainly," Siraja said. "But explorers and greedy princes care more about the legend."
She looked at me. I stared back. Her head was almost perfectly smooth, like polished ebony, and reminded me of nothing so much as the bust of the god Anubis. But here, in Ardeen. No one had ever heard of ancient Egypt except for me, Jason, and maybe some of the others I'd stranded here if they were still alive. Despite her non-human features, I could read her expression. I'd been here that long. She was looking at me as if she expected me to know what the hell she was talking about. So I shook my head and said, "All right, I'll bite. Tell me about this legend."
"Yes. Please finish your story," Mevish urged Siraja.
Startled, I jumped a little. Where the hell had she come from? Mevish hated me, I was certain. Sometimes she called me the half-wit. Once she'd suggested that she'd like to add my hair to her collection, whatever that meant. Given that she was supernaturally good at disappearing, then reappearing, while I was distracted, the whole hair collection thing freaked me out more than a little. Instead of jumping in surprise, Siraja flicked an ear at Mevish. "According to legend, the glass desert is all that remains of the Maker's Hall. It was once a vast castle of glass. It was the Maker's citadel in Ardeen. But what slagged and melted when Lotan burned hottest during the Age of Myth."
"Oh, right, stupid me. I knew that because I'd written a lot of the fake history for the Land of the Curse."
"Fake no more, Carter," I reminded myself. It was surreal. Siraja continued. "The legend says that beneath the desert, in bubbles and hollows, explorers can discover artifacts of the Age of Myth, stuff that was once kept in the Maker's Hall. But especially greedy types say that these are just the merest sprinkling of the true treasures waiting to be claimed, if one could find a surviving entrance to what remains of the hall's interior." Suddenly, the idea of exploring the singing crater sounded like the best idea I'd ever heard. And here I was smack dab in the center of the glass desert, which I'd completely forgotten was the Maker's home in this world's prehistory. Could it be a wild stroke of luck? No, nor mere coincidence. Yes, I'd translated blindly into Ardeen, but I'd obviously arrived at the site my older self thought of as home, the Maker's Hall. At least, what was left of it. Or maybe this was the place where my older self left Ardeen. When the Maker was killed by Jason, I frowned. Anyway, I wasn't going to look a gift horse in the mouth. If I could get into where the Maker version of me had done all his mojo, maybe I could make things right, take care of Jason, and eliminate whatever contamination he delivered to Earth in his Ardeen-built flash drive. I wanted to ask Jusher what it thought of the idea of my chances, but I'd made a point of not talking to the sphere since I'd come aboard the pirate ship. The last thing I needed was for it to spook them and give everyone yet another reason to hate me. A cry went up from the crow's nest. The crew of the pirate ship furled sails before us. Not more than a half a football field away was the crater's edge. Broken shards lay in haphazard heaps around it, in piles reaching dozens of feet high in places, forming a foreboding barrier without room for the ship to approach closer. I didn't see any easy footpaths, either. "This is the only way in?" I asked. Siraja shrugged. Captain Timon marched up, idly stroking the length of his muzzle like some men rub their beard while thinking. Spying us, he nodded in satisfaction.
"You have 3 days," he said. "If you're not back by then, we'll skate off and leave you to whatever end you find below."
"And what exactly should we bring out of that death trap, should we be so lucky?" demanded Mevish.
"Something worthy of your captain," said the Kefflum. "I leave what you might be to your imagination. Don't come back at all if you can't find something suitable."
since I was hoping to find something of the Maker and never return to the captain's wretched ship, I didn't ask him to be more specific. If I discovered what I hoped, I wouldn't need Timon and the Night Star to escape the glass desert. Hell, maybe I already had all I needed to find Jason and defeat him, or leave Ardeen and return to Earth, hidden somewhere in my Swiss cheese memory. I half-closed my eyes, trying to remember. But my recollections were as slippery as fish. Mevish prodded me. "Have your wits deserted you completely? What's wrong?" I blinked. "I was just thinking of a song I used to know," I lied. Mevish wasn't going to give me an inch, that was clear, even now, when our lives depended on us working together. Once we were off the ship, I decided the three of us needed to have a heart-to-heart about the situation. "Is everyone ready?" asked Siraja. Mevish turned slightly. I saw she wore a pack just like Siraja and I. My pack held rope, water, food for a few days, a utility knife, parchment, and a charcoal pen and a mirror. All things I'd requested and received from ship's stores in preparation for our trip. Really, all items I'd pack for a camping trip. A wiry privateer lowered a rope ladder over the side. I followed the others down its length, the rough rope thick and scratchy in my palms. We stood in the shadow cast by the ship, so the sun reflected in the glass didn't burn us like ants under a microscope, though the heat was still uncomfortable. A trickle of sweat inched down my back beneath my undershirt. "Which way?" I said. The forest of shards around the edge seemed impenetrable from where I stood. I'd hoped a path would become clear once we'd gotten down on the glass. Siraja shrugged again. Perhaps my earlier estimation of what her shrug meant had been off. Friendly or not, it was a gesture I was beginning to despise. She said, "We walk around until we see a path," she announced. Mevish glared without offering an opinion. I had nothing better to suggest, so I said, "Lay on, Macduff." I doubt she got the reference, though she didn't bother to ask what I meant either. Instead, Siraja moved to the left, leaving behind the cool shadow. Mevish and I followed. When the sun hit me, my skin prickled as it pulled taut and dry. After we'd gone a few dozen yards, I glanced back at the ship. A handful of heads were silhouetted up on the railing. A hand went up and waved, and raucous laughter floated across to us down on the reflective surface. The pirates watched, and no doubt were laying odds on how quickly we'd meet our end. But after only a few more paces, towering shards blocked the view. Hopefully, it was the last they'd ever see of us. Even if I didn't find my salvation in the crater, maybe we'd avoid returning to Nightstar courtesy of heatstroke or a razor-sharp glass avalanche. We walked in silence for several minutes. Though the heaped glass was dangerous, at least it sometimes shaded us from the sun. Other times, reflected light was so bright we could hardly see our way forward. "They sent us out here to die, you know," Mevish finally observed in a perfectly calm voice, as if she was commenting on the weather. Siraja stopped. She shook her head in negation, though not with the hearty confidence of someone who knows she is right. "Shit." "Listen," I said. "Timon is crap, yeah? But he doesn't strike me as someone who'd throw away perfectly good crew out of spite. There must be some hope of us finding a way in, or he'd have saved a lot of trouble by just letting us off in any old place on the glass." "He'd have done it by dragging," intoned Siraja. "Right," I said. "Dragging." I didn't know what death by dragging was, but I could imagine. I continued. "A public execution would generate a lot more solidarity and fear of the captain with the rest of the crew, whereas sending us off on some quest where no one can see us die robs him of that spectacle. If we die out here, everyone will just forget about us and move on, which means the captain, that twisted fuck, thinks we've got a chance. And we do, if we can all work together and put our differences behind us, at least on this mission. A sound plan, Saraja agreed. Then she actually grinned at me, which is sort of terrifying on a Keflum's face. We both glanced at Mevish. Mevish grunted, then drank from her water skin. I could tell it was already mostly empty. Mine was the same. When she didn't disagree, I decided to take it as agreement, however reluctant. So, I said, let's get serious about getting past this rim of broken glass to the crater itself. That's what we're doing, idiot, said Mevish. My hands didn't quite clench into fists. Instead, I said, right, but we need help. I'm running low on water already. Isn't there some kind of, I don't know, a story or myth about the Maker? Maybe one that talks about the Maker's Hall? Like, how the hell did the Maker get in and out of it? I risked spilling my secret desire, but these two needed a little motivation. I've seen the Maker's Hall, Mevish said, when I was young. The Maker's Hall was destroyed during the Age of Myth, said Saraja, and I doubt you're that old for all the stories they tell about you. Mevish continued as if Saraja hadn't interrupted. Once, when all the moons were painted across the sky in a perfect line, I saw the Maker's Hall. I saw it reflected in the glass desert, tall, terrible, but beautiful, shimmering like a ghost. I swallowed. What did it look like exactly? Mounting, shining ramparts reached for the sky. I saw a single entrance, a gate whose opulence outshone a dragon's hoard. I was with my mother. She said that if we dared, we could attempt to enter and there seize the power of the Maker himself. Mevish stopped speaking, but her braids twined of their own accord. Did you try to enter? Asked Saraja. No. Creatures of broken glass rose up and chased us off. I'd bluffed Mevish before when I got her to switch allegiances and back Saraja instead of Kadir. I'd only been able to suss out that she wasn't a native of Ardeen. She was a stranger. I'd known instinctively that if I branded her with that term, the pirates would have turned against her. But for all my assurance, I really didn't know anything else. So, I wondered who Mevish really was, who her mother had been, and where they'd come from, if not Ardeen. Neither she nor anyone like her had appeared in any of the original code. I knew that with relative certainty. Before I could give in to my curiosity, the sound of piping flutes distracted me. Saraja, Mevish, and I all glanced in the direction of the unexpected melody. A sort of lullaby, maybe. One whose words danced just on the edge of memory. After only a few bars, it faded back to nothing. We looked at each other, then hastened forward. Another 100 yards brought us to a sloping pane of glass, with a shape reminiscent of an elephant's flared ears. On the far side, there was a gap that led inward, toward the edge. It was the first one we'd seen. Saraja said, "That looks promising." "It looks unstable," Judge Mevis. "What do you think, Carter?" asked Saraja. Mevish was right. The first pane was tented against a series of crumpled glass shards, which we'd have to pass under to get through. If we brushed against it, the whole thing might come crashing down on us. Even if we were careful, a strong wind seemed likely to collapse it. On the other hand, the heat was doing me in.
passage was dark and out of the sun. Concentrating on the glass, I tried to determine if it had any sort of inner essence or name that I could question or command. Nothing. I closed my eyes, focusing harder. "Nope. It's just a heap of rubble," I said, opening my eyes. "I don't know how safe it is." Mevish snorted. "Your little trick of knowing secrets not working? Remember, we're a team. Team members support each other, not belittle failure." Mevish actually laughed, and Saraja smiled again. "Progress? Maybe." The music came again, louder than before. It was definitely coming from inside the crater, echoing through the tunnel of glass debris. Words accompanied the music this time, but not ones I could understand. "This has got to be the way," said Saraja, and ducked into the opening. Her body blocked the light at the far end. After a few seconds, her voice came back, hollow and faint. "Come, it's fine." "Fuck dithering," I followed. The air was noticeably cooler in the tunnel, which was a welcome relief. I hoped the shadows didn't hide a jagged piece of glass as I inched carefully forward. The tunnel didn't collapse on me, and I made it through. Saraja waited for me on the other side. She was perched at the edge of a massive hole in the glass in an area relatively free of debris. The cavity was circular, stretching at least a half mile in diameter. Churning white mist filled it, hiding the crater's bottom, presuming it had a bottom. Mevish emerged from the tunnel. She moved to put Saraja between herself and me. She sniffed, then crinkled her nose as if in disgust. Though I couldn't smell anything, I decided not to ask what she'd sniffed. Instead, I carefully swept my gaze around the periphery, looking for some way to safely descend into the cloying whiteness. I bent to retrieve a loose piece of broken glass, then spun the fragment down into the mist. A dull, crashing noise echoed out of the whiteness, probably not more than a couple of seconds later. "Now our presence is known," hissed Mevish. "By who?" I countered, but feeling guilty all the same. She had no answer, but she'd been right to reprimand me. Tossing glass into the pit had certainly announced our presence if anyone was hiding down in the mist. I can be an idiot sometimes. About 200 yards farther along the rim, I spied what looked like a pile of dead animals. "Look," I said, pointing. Saraja followed my finger. Her eyes widened. "A chimera. A dead one, though. I didn't think they ever flew out over the desert." At her words, image resolved in my head. Instead of three animals, I realized it was one creature with three heads, one goat, one lion, and one freaky-looking lizard face. Its long, green tail dangled into the crater, and its end was obscured by the roiling fog. "What killed it?" I said, hoping no one suggested that the mist was poison. I watched Saraja, waiting for the shrug. She didn't disappoint. "We should go check it out," I said. "How do you propose we get across to it?" said Mevish. The area where we stood was relatively clear of shards, but if we wanted to move along the edge in either direction for more than a dozen yards, we'd be faced with jagged barriers sharp as, well, broken glass. Finding out what had killed the chimera would be useful information to have, probably, but I didn't fancy slicing open a femoral artery on a trek across the sharp mess to find out. "Maybe later," I finally said. Saraja said, "Then let's head into the crater. We're wasting time up here." She dropped her pack and removed a thick coil of rope. Loop after loop, the Keflin unfurled one end down the side of the great cavity. "Any idea how deep it is?" I asked. "We're going to find out," Mavish answered as Saraja continued letting the rope out. Stop asking questions we can't answer, or I'll push you over.
The Kefflum's ears twitched at that last. Did she think Mavish was funny, or was she annoyed too?
Just my luck to be partnered with someone who might actually want me dead, and I wasn't really all that sure about Siraj's regard.
Too bad Jisher wasn't more able-bodied. What the hell? I pulled the sphere from a pouch and addressed it. Jisher, advise me.
On what? The sphere responded.
Mavish gasped.
Saraja paused in her work to regard me. I said to the metallic orb, we mean to descend this cavity and through it, to enter the ruins of the Maker's Hall. How should we proceed?
Jisher's form rotated creepily in my hand as if to take in my companions, the crater, then slid back to me.
Anyone may enter the ruins, it said. They lie scattered beneath this hard plain. But only the Maker may enter the original hall. Him, or at a minimum, four of the seven incarnations acting in concert. Since the Maker is dead, only the incarnations or their implements can enter. Gather those rings, and you will succeed beyond your wildest hopes. Call the rings, and they may come.
You keep an artifact of sorcery? Said Saraja, her voice high with surprise. Why didn't you use it to improve your station on the Night Star?
I was too busy considering Jusher's response to answer.
The object knew my relationship to the Maker, I'd told it, which meant that it didn't think I had enough Maker in me to successfully enter whatever remained of the hall. On the other hand, it thought I could call the implements of the incarnation. Rings, apparently. What did that?
Circles, sizzling with powerful magic. Seven in all. Seven for seven incarnations cascaded across my vision. The rings, the Maker, that I had given to the incarnations as the catalyst for their power. Rings of war, death, silence, commerce, law, lore, and desire. The memory faded like ice cream dropped on a sun-warmed sidewalk. Before it completely melted, I seized it with everything that I could dredge up of my newfound ability. I fixed that memory in my mind by naming it as mine. I would not forget it. If the Maker knew it, so should I. The Maker was gone, but maybe I could reconstruct a workable facade of what he'd been. Memory by memory, what I had been. If I could accomplish that, maybe I'd be able to enter the hall without calling the rings. On the other hand, a little insurance couldn't hurt. Maybe trying to call them was exactly what I should do.
Carter, are you...
Hold on, I told Saraja. Would it work? Probably not. On the other hand, if I didn't try, how would I ever know? Maybe I could even tune the entreaty to exclude war from hearing. Last time Jason saw me, he'd been happy to see me shot. Concentrating on images I just glued to the inside of my brain, I whispered,
"Come, rings of incarnation. It is I, your Maker, calling. Return to me in my hour of need. If worn, then I command you, the wearer, to find me. The ring will know the way. If I speak instead to a mute band, find me. Find a wearer and lead them to me."
I was pretty sure nothing was happening. Screwing my eyes shut, I meditated on all seven implements at once and called again, repeating my message silently in my mind. I imagined the rings, or whoever held them now, or anyone who had once held or would hold the rings of incarnation, receiving my summons. Unfortunately, I couldn't exclude war, after all. It was one of the seven.